Thanks all again for being here. Thanks for those of you who are tuning in. We do have a nice following of people who tune in on Sunday mornings or who watch afterwards, so that's really good to know as well. So I'm continuing on this series, the Being All In series for Christ and His work. And so last week I asked this kind of inescapable yet dangerous question, Lord, what do you want me to do with my life? And so when you ask that question, it is dangerous, and if you're going to answer it, then there's a certain element of answering the question, are you going to be all in? I mean, are we tentative with that? If we ask that question, what do you want me to do with my life, is that something we stick our toe in, sort of like when we're getting ready to get into the pool? Or is that something that when God says, this is what I want you to do, is that what we do? And so And so the Lord replies, when we ask that question, I want you to die to yourself, to kill the old self, to put on a new self over into the image of Christ Jesus. So last week I talked about that to us and to the world. The most inspiring act Jesus ever did was to suffer and die as our atoning substitutionary sacrifice on the cross. And that now, to other Christians and to the world, the most inspiring thing a Christian can ever do is to take up their cross and follow Jesus. That's the expectation. So that big picture, broad brush kind of thing, the Lord expects us to take up our cross and to follow Him. That's not negotiable. So anyway, in other words, to do and to be what Jesus would do if He were us in the here and now. And we just spent some time on picking up our cross from Matthew 16, verses 13 through 28. And so I won't go into all of that now, but it's the passage where the Apostle Paul, where Jesus responds to Peter by saying to him that if anyone would come after him, that he must take up his cross and follow him. And so, part of the question then when we read that is, what is our cross? What is your cross? Do we each have a cross? And have we picked it up? And are we prepared to endure and to embrace what that cross might mean for us? So Christ wants us to pick up a cross and to follow him. This is unequivocal. And then I concluded by this, a couple of statements from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a remarkable theologian of the 20th century, who said that when Christ calls a man, he bids him to come and to die. And then I read a lengthy just quote about what his comments on cheap grace. And if you haven't read it, right now, if you want to, get your phone out and just type in the search line, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, quote, cheap grace, and read it later on. And it is one of the most profound statements any theologian has written in the 20th century. So bless yourselves by reading that. Now, that's what we did last week. And I want to talk this week about something that's a little different. And I want to begin with a story. And probably as I'm on this series, I'm going to try and convey to you some powerful stories of people who were all in, who understood what it meant to surrender everything because there was a greater thing at stake. And so they gave it all and they did it all. And so this is a story about a guy named Joshua Chamberlain. Joshua Chamberlain was a student of theology and a professor of rhetoric, not a soldier. But when duty called, Chamberlain answered. He climbed the ranks to become a colonel of the 20th Maine Volunteer Infantry Regiment of the Union Army. On July 2nd, 1863, Chamberlain and his 300-soldier regiment were all that stood between the Confederates and certain defeat at a battlefield in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. At 2:30 p.m., the 15th and the 47th Alabama Infantry Regiments of the Confederate Army charged. But Chamberlain and his men held their ground. Then followed a second, third, fourth, and fifth charge from the Confederate Army. By the last charge, only 80 Blues stood standing out of 250. Chamberlain himself was knocked down by a bullet that hit his belt buckle, but the 34-year-old school teacher got right back up. It was his date with destiny. When Sergeant Tozier informed Chamberlain that no reinforcements were coming and his men were down to one round of ammunition per soldier, Chamberlain knew he needed to act decisively. Their lookout, a young boy perched high in a tree on Little Round Top, informed Colonel Chamberlain that the Confederates were forming rank to charge again. The rational thing to do at that point, with no ammunition and no reinforcements, would have been to surrender. But Chamberlain wasn't wired that way. He made a defining decision that turned the tide of the war and single-handedly saved the Union. In full view of the enemy, Chamberlain climbed onto their barricade of stones and gave a command. He pointed his sword and yelled, "Charge!" His men fixed bayonets and started running at the Confederate Army, which vastly outnumbered them. They caught them off guard by executing a great right wheel in what ranks as one of the most improbable victories in military history. 80 Union soldiers captured 4,000 Confederates in 5 minutes flat. What seemed like a suicide mission saved the Union. Historians believe that if Chamberlain had not charged, the rebels would have gained the high ground. If the rebels had gained the high ground, there's a good chance they would have won the Battle of Gettysburg. If the rebels had won that battle, the historical consensus is that the Confederates would have won the war. One man's courage saved the day, saved the war, saved the Union. It all began with just one man. It all began with his character and integrity. And from that one man and his determination to persevere, regardless of the odds, 80 soldiers, battered, beaten, charged 4,000 Confederate soldiers and captured them. He took charge of something small in his life. And because he took charge of that thing in his life, he was able to charge up his men, to get them to charge 4,000 soldiers, and to save the battle, the war, and the Union. After the war, Joshua Chamberlain went on to serve as the 32nd governor of Maine and the president of his alma mater, Bowdoin College. In 1893, 30 years after his act of heroism, he was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Grover Cleveland. It's just like the government come along a little late, huh? So 30 years after that, he got some recognition. Holding his position at the Little Round Top against repeated assaults and carrying the advanced position on the Great Round Top. In his later years, Chamberlain would reflect back on the war with these words, "I had a deep within me the inability to do nothing." The inability to do nothing. Are we a kind of people that have the inability to do nothing? Are we treading water? Are we hanging in there? Have we kind of declared a kind of peace with the rest of the world, with the enemy himself? Or have we taken charge of our lives and all of the components of our lives? You know, those components that give us character, that give us passion, that give us purpose. What kind of people are we in that regard? So what defined him was the inability to do nothing. Is that something that defines us? Does it define you? Does it define me? There isn't a person here that isn't necessary to the vitality and life of this church and to the church as a whole. There isn't a person here that hasn't been given a cross of sorts to bear in the life of this church and in the world in which you live. And that is what we will be judged by. Being all in means being faithful in the small things, which leads to great success in the bigger things. Being all in means being faithful in the small things, which leads to great success in the bigger things. In Colonel Chamberlain's life, it began with his character, which saved the Union. Are you in charge of the small things in your life? Do you understand the importance that they play in the formation of who you are and your capacity to do greater things than you could ever imagine or could ever see? Maybe some of you have heard this kind of proverb: for want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the message was lost. For want of a message, the battle was lost. For want of the battle, the kingdom was lost. And all for the want of a nail. Any of you who do work at home know how many times you've been stymied because you had a piece of equipment that was missing a tiny little screw. And you couldn't use that piece of equipment, and you couldn't get to that job, and that job that you needed to get to, maybe it would pay big dividends in some sort or another, but you couldn't get to that because of that tiny little screw. The other day I was cleaning my garage, and I saw this tiny little screw laying on the floor of the garage. Now, in years past, I was like, just sweep it along. But no, where did that little screw come from? And just how valuable might that little screw be to help run something that's just really, really important? So it's easy to ignore what we think are the smaller things in life and to not take charge of them without realizing how utterly important they can be in making us able to do something much bigger than we could ever grasp or understand. Life gets away from us when we do that. Now, I have a biblical text that I want to explore and spend some time on. And it's about a guy named Caleb, who was an Old Testament hero. And you can read about him in your Bibles in Numbers chapter 13 and 14 and Joshua chapter 14. So, for Caleb, being all in meant faithfully taking charge with, in some senses, a relatively small thing that also impacted an enormous thing. So we read here, and if you want to turn to your Bibles, you can. I'll have a lot of it up here on the screen, where the Lord provides a test. And about 2 years have passed since they miraculously escaped from Egypt, where they were in bondage for 400 years. So they'd gotten out of Egypt. They traveled for about 2 years. And they were about to enter into the land of Canaan, that the land that had been promised to them. Now understand, at the time that they left Egypt, that Egypt in the world in that day was a superpower. Egypt was a superpower. And this ragtag band of 600,000 Israelites managed to escape a superpower and to make their way across the Sinai Peninsula to enter into the land of Canaan. In order to do that, they had just seen these miraculous plagues that God had unleashed on Pharaoh and Egypt because he insisted on keeping them. Those were the plagues where the water turned to blood, the plague of frogs, the plague of lice, the plague of flies, the plague upon the disease of livestock, the plague of unhealable boils, the plague of hail, the plague of locusts, the plague of darkness, and the death of the firstborn during the Passover. All of these plagues were insults to the gods of Egypt. They were very specific about getting at the kind of gods that the Egyptians worshiped. So that's why they were the plagues that they were. But Israel, all 600,000 of them, had seen this take place in Egypt. They had just seen these unbelievable miracles happen to a superpower, and understand that any nation that was a superpower back then believed they were a superpower because that's what God wanted them to be. So if these bad things were happening to them, then what does that say about their gods? So they left here to go into the land of Canaan, to reoccupy the land of Canaan, a land that had been promised. It's where the land where Abram had lived and had been promised to him, where he and his descendants would possess that land. And so now God was taking them back. This was also during the time, as they were leaving Egypt, that all 600,000 of them, while the Pharaoh was pursuing them, that they saw the parting of the Red Sea. This unbelievable thing, where this huge and vast body of water parted for them so they could go through in order to escape Egypt. Now, 2 years later, after this all happens, they're about to enter into the land of Canaan. So here we read in Numbers chapter 13, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the people of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, every one a chief among them." So there were 12 tribes. And so each tribe was to send one of their chiefs, one of their leaders, to be spies to go into the land of Canaan. So the best and the brightest, the most trusted, the men who had the most integrity, the people that you would trust the most, people who had been elected leaders, that from every tribe, this kind of person was supposed to come to be a spy to go into the land of Canaan. People who had courage, people who were resourceful, people who were faithful. Those 12 men were supposed to be that. So we read in verse 3. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the people of Israel. And so he names all of them. Verse 6, from the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. So now we see Caleb as a part of those 12. So I didn't list all 12 because I can't pronounce most of their names, but I can pronounce Caleb, and I just wanted to, cut some time. So they are sent on this dangerous reconnaissance mission, and it's a test by Yahweh, by God. They are sent on this dangerous reconnaissance mission. So, and so we read here in verse 17, Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up into Negeb and go up into the hill country and see what the land is. So now Moses is giving them instructions. In your reconnaissance, these are the things that I want you to find out and come back and report to me the exact nature of the things that I am asking you to find. Verse 18, and see what the land is, and whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak. That would certainly be a good thing to do militarily, to assess your enemy, and whether they are few or many. Verse 19, and whether the land that they dwell in is good or bad. Is this a good place to live? And whether the cities they dwell in are camps or strongholds. So do they have just a bunch of tents like the Midianites? Or are they in big cities that are fortified? Archaeologists, for example, revealed that the land was heavily defended at that time. The city of Hazor, for example, consisted of an upper city of 26 acres and a lower city of 160 acres with a population of 40,000 people. This would have been one of the cities that they would have attacked. Its defenses were massively built stone and mud brick walls. Some of those walls measured 24 feet thick. This was a place that was well fortified. And this is exactly what Moses wanted the spies to discover. So, verse 20, and whether the land is rich or poor, whether there are trees in it or not, so that we can have building materials, evidence of water, things like that. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land back with you. So they, the spies, went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin to Rehob to Lebonapath. I'm sorry, that's Lebohamath. That's the word, Lebohamath. And they went into the Negeb and came to Hebron, and then all of these different cities that he names. And then he notes that the descendants of Anak were there. And so that's an important thing to remember. This is the scope of where the spies went up. So if you go on to the next slide, that's a map of what Israel or Palestine or Canaan would have looked like at the time. And their travels took them about 250 miles north, back and forth, weaving through the land for about 40 days. These 12 men, these spies, and again, I just want to say to you, you don't leave Egypt and do what you did to Egypt and start making your way to Canaan without word reaching Canaan, that there's this massive group of people moving your direction. So it would have behooved the spies to be very careful, because if they had been identified by anybody in the land of Canaan, they probably would have been killed. So it was, in all likelihood, a very dangerous mission. For 250 miles north, that's just not straight miles, that's about the distance as far north as they went, but they would have gone back and forth through the land, exploring and finding out what the land had, so they could give a full report to Moses. Verse 25, and at the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land. Now here's the thing that's really interesting. That prior to going into the land of Canaan to spy, these men probably did not know each other very well, or if at all, before this reconnaissance mission. They came out of 600,000 people. They were leaders of their own tribes, and they were spread out as they traveled. So in all likelihood, most of them didn't know each other very well at all. But they were thrown together in this mission that Moses gave to them. So no doubt, though, that while they were traveling for 40 days, they became this band of brothers, drawn together by their common faith, ethnicity, daily danger, sleeping in the same place, cooking and eating, talking about family, sharing war stories. Many of you have gone on retreats for a weekend, and you went on a retreat with people that you did not know very well. But by the time Sunday afternoon came, you had grown to know who your roommates were, who your cabin mates were, and to appreciate them and even love them. Some of you have vacationed with people that you didn't know. You were kind of thrown in together. But at the end of the vacation, in most cases, you probably ended up caring about these people because you'd gotten to know them in just 5 days, 6 days. These men spent 40 days together doing all of this stuff. They had become a band of brothers. So you can imagine the surprise that Caleb might have had when they reported the following. Verse 27. And they, all of the spies except for Caleb, told him, that is Moses, we came to the land to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey. So the idea of milk and honey is that milk was a standard kind of food. So it flows with milk. It has all of the basics that we need. It flows with honey. It has food that is delicious to taste. It's really good. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there, the Nephilim, the giants, the great men of war who fought fiercely in battle, who were legendary, these huge people who were highly skilled, who fought on the forefront of any battle. The descendants of Anak were there. Verse 30, but Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. I mean, talk about cognitive dissonance, right? I mean, first of all, Caleb had to be surprised that this was the response of these other 11 men that he traveled with. And his response was not to get in line. His response was not to affirm what it was that they said. His response was not to become fearful like they were. His response was, let's go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. Caleb was all in. Caleb knew just as well as anybody else what the risks were. He knew what their resources were. He remembered the miracles in Egypt and at the Red Sea. Verse 31. Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go against the people, for they are stronger than we." So now these spies have convinced the rest of Israel that they are not able to go against the people in Canaan. Verse 32. So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of a great height." They are bigger than we are. They are stronger. This land devours people. This ominous image, right? Caleb's like, "Hey, get in line. Let's go get them." And these people are talking about, "But they're going to eat you." Verse 33. "And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." Now, if any of you don't know who the Nephilim are, the Nephilim are a kind of people that are described in Genesis of angelic beings who intermarried with women on earth. And they produced children who were physically far bigger and far stronger, and they were called the Nephilim. So this is what the biblical text tells us. So now I will say to you that you know, in the interpretive work here, that there are some people who believe the Nephilim were simply warriors of great renown who had these huge narratives that followed them, and that, you know, and that typically they probably would be larger guys and all that kind of stuff, all the way up to that these are actually giants. And so my own self, I think they were actually giants. I'm just saying to you that's the scope of how people interpret who the Nephilim, regardless of whether they were giants or whether they were magnificent warriors. The point is, they were these incredibly intimidating people who terrified the Israelites. Verse 34. "Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night." Total despair. Complete discouragement. Caved. "And all of the people grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them," get this. This is what they said, "Would that we have died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in this wilderness. It would have been better," they said, 2 years away from Egypt. "It would have been better if we died in Egypt than to be here. It would have been better if we died in the wilderness than to be here." Then the next verse says, "Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." This is the complete reversal of who Caleb is and what Caleb did and said. This is a people who were not all in. They were feckless. They said all of this despite these incredible miracles that they saw in Egypt. Despite the fact that they saw the parting of the Red Sea and Pharaoh's army utterly destroyed. It had to be a part of their most recent memories. And they caved. And they not only caved, they blamed God. They betrayed him. They accused him of setting them up. Now, before we get all self-righteous about the Israelites, understand, most of us fight this battle in principle multiple times a year. We see God's faithfulness in our lives every day. Some of us experience unbelievable blessings, and something comes along. My wife has a coworker. 2 years ago, she came in. It was a series of like really hot days, like, you know, 95 degrees, high humidity. They walked in and said to her, "I don't know why God hates us so much." Now, this is a person who does quite well, and they have lots of money to spend, and they do pretty much what they want. But somehow God hates them, hates her, because he provided 3 or 4 days of really hot weather. We are that shallow sometimes. We are that forgetful. But it's easy to be that shallow, and it's easy to be that forgetful when we're not all in. When it's only our toe being dipped in the water, in the pool of our faith, and not our whole being. So unlike Caleb, and despite the miracles witnessed in Egypt, the other leaders from other tribes were unwilling to go all in. Verse 5. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the people of Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes in grief. Now, I do want to say this about Caleb. This is an important thing. When this was all happening, Caleb had never been part of the inner circle of the leadership of Israel. Moses was the apex figure, and Aaron was the high priest, and Joshua was the military leader. They formed the triumvirate of the nation of Israel. Caleb was just a local leader from the tribe of Judah. I mean, it didn't matter that he was not part of that inner circle. He was faithful despite that. Sometimes we look to other Christian leaders and we think, it's your job only to lead the way. When in reality, there's lots of room for Caleb's. Does this make sense to you? And so they said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, "The land which we passed through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. We will consume them. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." And the response of the congregation, they said, then all the congregation said, to stone them with stones. That would be Moses, Aaron, Joshua, and Caleb. But the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the people of Israel. And so the response is that the Lord protects Moses, Joshua, Aaron, and Caleb. He threatens to disinherit the rest of Israel because of their unfaithfulness. But Moses intercedes and advocates on their behalf. And God relents, but says this, Everyone over 20 will not enter the land of the promised land, the land of Canaan, except Moses, Joshua, Aaron, and Caleb. They were the only ones of all of those people, 600,000, that will be allowed to enter the land of Canaan at some future date because of their lack of faithfulness. Anyone over 20 years of age. Verse 22, none of the men who had seen my glory and my signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and yet have put me to the test these 10 times have not obeyed my voice. See, shall see the land that I swore to give to their fathers, and none of those who despised me will see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, he's all in, I will bring into the land that which he went, and his descendants shall possess it. So what happens? We read 45 years later in the book of Joshua this. Then the people of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb said to him, you know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again, as it was in my heart. And so, we read here in Joshua 14, but my brothers who went up with me made the heart of the people melt. Yet I wholly, wholly followed the Lord my God. So after they possessed the land, he met with Moses and he had this to say. In retrospect, he's saying, but my brothers who went up with me and spied with me in Canaan made the heart of the people melt, yet I wholly followed the Lord my God. Then we read in Joshua 14, 10 and 11, and now behold, the Lord has kept me alive. 45 years later, just as he said, these 45 years since the time the Lord spoke this word to Moses, while Israel walked in the wilderness, and now behold, I am this day 85 years old. I am still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming. So now, he says to Joshua, this is what he says to Joshua, give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me and I shall drive them out, just as the Lord said. These were the people. Caleb wanted the land and the cities that the people rejected 45 years. They were terrified of that specific place in Canaan. They were afraid of those people in that part of the hill country. And what does Caleb do? Give me those people, he says. It doesn't, the spies that were with me, they melted the hearts of the people because of the report that they gave about these people that now I want from you, Joshua, so I can go in and I can conquer them. I am not afraid of those strong cities. I am not afraid of those Nephilim. Give them to me. Caleb doubled down. Wouldn't you like to be a Caleb? Wouldn't you like to have the legacy that a Caleb has? We can. It's not that that's elusive or that it's not possible for us. It certainly is. It's just a matter of us deciding about how much or how far or how deep we are all in. More than ever before in the history of this church, I need everyone in this room and anyone who's listening to be all in. what the Lord has store for us in store for us in the future is significant. And to the degree that we are all in together, we will be able to be faithful and respond to those challenges that will come our way. And there will be challenges. So being all in then for these big things means taking charge of everyday things. No more treading water, no more passive engagement, no more hope without obedience, no more defense and not offense. We have to take charge. We have to take charge of our marriages. We have to take charge of our finances. We have to take charge of our health. We have to take charge of any addictions. We have to take charge of our children. We have to take charge of setting meaningful goals. We have to take charge of our church responsibilities. And those responsibilities align themselves with our talents and our resources. We have to take charge of kingdom causes. We have to take charge of our relationship with Jesus Christ. This is the weekend of 9/11. There was a great example of a man who took charge, who despite his circumstances made a profound difference because he was all in because of the nature of his character and his principles and his faith. Todd Beamer graduated from Wheaton College. Todd Beamer worshiped at a Christian and Missionary Alliance church. This is, if I can get through it, this is the transcript of Todd Beamer's last phone call. Todd, hello, operator, listen to me. I can't speak very loud. This is an emergency. I'm a passage on a United flight to San Francisco. We have a situation here. Our plane has been hijacked. Can you understand me? Lisa, exhaling a deep breath to herself. I understand. Can the hijacker see you talking on the phone? Todd, no. Lisa, can you tell me how many hijackers are on the plane? Todd, there are three that we know of. Lisa, can you see any weapons? What kind of weapons do they have? Todd, yes. They don't have guns. They have knives. They took over the plane with knives. Lisa, do you mean like steak knives? No, these are razor knives, like box cutters. Lisa, can you tell me what country these people are from? No, I don't know. They sound like they're from the Mideast. Lisa, have they said what they want? Todd, someone announced from the cockpit that there was a bomb on board. He said he was the captain and to stay in our seats and stay quiet. He said that they were meeting these men's demands and returning to the airport. It was very broken English, and I'm telling you, it sounded fake. Lisa, okay, sir. Please give me your name. My name is Todd Beamer. Lisa, okay, Todd, my name is Lisa. Do you know your flight number? If you can't remember, it's on your ticket. It's United Flight 93. Now, Todd, can you tell me exactly what happened? Todd, two of the hijackers were sitting in first class near the cockpit. A third one was sitting near the back of the coach section. The two up front got into the cockpit somehow. There was shouting. The third hijacker said he had a bomb. It looks like a bomb. He's got it tied to his waist with a red belt of some kind. Lisa, so the door to the cockpit is open? Todd, no, the hijackers shut it behind them. Lisa, has anyone been injured? Todd, yes. They killed one passenger sitting in first class. There's been lots of shouting. We don't know if the pilots are dead or alive. A flight attendant told me that the pilot and co-pilot had been forced from the cockpit. Many have been wounded and may have been wounded. Lisa, where is the third hijacker now, Todd? Todd, he's near the back of the plane. They forced most of the passengers into the first class. There are 14 of us here in the back. Five are flight attendants. He hasn't noticed that I slipped into this pantry to get the phone. The guy with the bomb ordered us to sit on the floor in the rear of the plane. Oh, Jesus, help. Lisa, Todd, are you okay? What's happening? Todd, hello, we're going down. I think we're going to crash. Wait a minute. No, we're leveling off. We're okay. I think we may be turning around. That's it. We've changed directions. Do you hear me? We're flying east again. Okay, Todd, what's going on with the other passengers? Everyone is really scared. A few passengers with cell phones have made calls to relatives. A guy, Jeremy, was talking to his wife just before the hijacking started. He told him that the hijackers have crashed two planes into the World Trade Center. Lisa, is that true? Todd, I have to tell you the truth. It's very bad. The World Trade Center is gone. Both of the towers have been destroyed. Todd, oh God, help us. Lisa, a third plane was taken over by terrorists. It crashed into the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Our country is under attack, and I'm afraid that your plane may be part of their plan. Oh, dear God. Dear God, Lisa, will you do something for me? I will try if I can, yes. I want you to call my wife and my kids for me and tell them what's happened. Promise me you'll call. I promise, I'll call. Here's my home number. You have the same name as my wife, Lisa. We've been married for 10 years. She's pregnant with our third child. Tell her that I love her, choking up. I always love her, and then he cleared his throat. We have two boys, David, he's 3, and Andrew, he's 1. Tell them, and he choked again, tell them that their daddy loves them and that he's so proud of them, clearing his throat again. Our baby is due January 12th. I saw an ultrasound. It was great. We still don't know if it's a girl or a boy. Lisa? Lisa, barely able to speak. I'll tell them, I promise, Todd. Todd, I'm going back to the group. If I can get back, I will. Todd, leave this line open. Are you still there? Lisa dials the phone. Hello, FBI. My name is Lisa Jefferson. I'm the telephone supervisor for GTE. I need to report a terrorist hijacking of United Airlines Flight 93. Yes, I'll hold. Goodwin. Hello, this is Agent Goodwin. I understand you have a hijacking situation. Lisa. Yes, sir. I've been talking with a passenger, Todd Beamer, on Flight 93, who managed to get to an airphone unnoticed. Goodwin, where did this flight originate, and what was its destination? Lisa, the flight left Newark, New Jersey at 8 a.m., departing from San Francisco. The hijackers took over the plane shortly after takeoff, and several minutes later, the plane changed course. It's now flying east. Goodwin, Ms. Jefferson, I need to talk to someone aboard that plane. Can you get me through to the plane's phone? Lisa, I still have that line open, sir. I can patch you through on a conference call. Hold on a moment. Todd, Lisa, are you there? Lisa, yes, I'm here, Todd. I made the call to the FBI. Agent Goodwin is on the line and will be talking to you as well. Todd, the others all know that this isn't your normal hijacking. Jeremy called his wife again on his cell phone. She told him more about the World Trade Center and all. Goodwin. Hello, Todd. This is Agent Goodwin with the FBI. We have been monitoring your flight. Your plane is on course for Washington, D.C. These terrorists sent two planes into the World Trade Center and one plane into the Pentagon. Our best guess is that they plan to fly your plane into either the White House or the United States Capitol building. Todd, I understand. Hold on. I'll be back. Lisa, Mr. Goodwin, how much time do they have before they get to Washington? Goodwin, not long, ma'am. They changed course over Cleveland. They're approaching Pittsburgh now. Washington may be 20 minutes away. Todd, breathing a little heavier, the plane seems to be changing directions just a little. It's getting pretty rough up here. The plane is flying really erratic. We're not going to make it out of here. Listen to me. I want you to hear this. I have talked to the others. We have decided we would not be pawns in these hijackers' suicidal plot. Todd, what are you going to do? Todd, we've hatched a plan. 4 of us are going to rush the hijacker with the bomb. After we take him out, we'll break into the cockpit. A stewardess is getting some boiling water to throw on the hijackers at the controls. We'll get them and we'll take them out. Lisa, will you do one last thing for me? Yes, what it is. Would you pray with me? They pray, Our Father, which is in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive our trespassers. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Todd speaks more softly. God help me. Jesus help me. Then he clears his throat and says louder, he says, are you guys ready? Let's roll. So one of my literary heroes that I have is a guy named Dag Hammarskjöld, who is the Secretary General of the UN. And he said this, we are not permitted to choose the frame of our destiny, but what we put into it is ours. He who wills adventure will experience it according to the measure of his courage. He who wills sacrifice will be sacrificed according to the measure of his purity of heart. Todd Beamer was all in. He was another person who was determined that evil would not prevail, and that in whatever way he could, he would limit the impact of the evil that was already taking place. So we have this Colonel Jacobson. We have this amazing person named Caleb. We have modern day examples like Todd Beamer. We know what it is that God calls us to, and that regardless of our circumstances, no matter how easy or how hard, we are called to be all in. Will you be all in with me? Are there new ways that we can find to be a better church? That we can be more effective? That we can find new and creative ways to be additionally faithful? I hope so. I want you to pray in that way. It's time to move forward. It's time to open this church up. It's time for us to do the fullness of what it is that we are capable of doing. And I don't even know what all that means. I just know it's time for us all to be all in.